Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. This week I have some sage advice for you on a couple of matters, and also Mysteries of the Mind, brought to you by 678 nuns. So, let's get started with a few useful tips. The first one is this. Good news if you like your extra virgin olive oil. Now, I had always been taught and had seen this in multiple places, so I thought it was true, but it's not. The smoke point of an oil is believed to be correlated with the safety and stability of the oil under heat. And I was always taught, well, if you're going to be frying something at a high temperature, use coconut oil. That's the least unhealthy of the saturated fats. And if you're going to be doing a braise or something, you can do it with the olive oil, but you shouldn't heat the olive oil to the smoke point. Turns out that's wrong. Science marches on. Researchers at the Modern Olives Laboratory Services in Australia. Okay, fair enough. It's they might have a little bit of proprietary thing here, but they did get themselves published in a peer-reviewed journal, the ACTA Scientific Nutritional Health. So I'm going to buy that. At least they were lying through their teeth. This is probably true. What they said was that they did this at an ISO 17025 accredited laboratory. I'm presuming that means that an independent licensed laboratory that gets inspected and stuff like that. Extra virgin olive oil and other common cooking oils were heated up to 240 degrees centigrade. That's hot. And exposed to 180 centigrade for 6 hours, with samples being tested at various times, testing smoke point, oxidative stability, free fatty acids, polar compounds, fatty acid profiles, and UV ultraviolet coefficients. So extra virgin olive oil yielded low levels of polar compounds and oxidative byproducts, in contrast to high levels of byproducts generated by oils such as canola oil, which also is a high oleic acid oil, but maybe not so good if you're going to heat it up hot. The reason for this is that extra virgin olive oil has a lot of flavonoids with a high antioxidant content. So the fatty acid profile and these antioxidants allowed the oil to remain stable when heated. This is unlike the oils that they tested with high levels of polyunsaturated fatty acids, which degraded much more readily. So the study reveals that under the conditions used in the study, smoke point does not predict oil performance when heated. And so of all the oils tested, extra virgin olive oil was the winner. And I am very pleased because now I don't have to worry about smoking olive oil being bad for me. That makes me especially happy. So my next bit of advice for you is about scheduling surgery, where and when. Let's start out with the when. Researchers from Houston Methodist Hospital, UCLA, the University of Toronto, and others have tried to answer a long-standing fear that undergoing surgery on a Friday leads to higher levels of complication or even death. Their analysis of data from close to 500,000 patients, 429,691, revealed higher rates of complications, readmissions, and mortality in the days and weeks following surgery on Friday compared to those who had surgery earlier in the week. This is called sometimes the weekend effect, and this is not a newly observed trend, but this validates it extremely well. In surgical settings, people do worse if they're admitted over the weekend. Not much gets done. Often they're kept fasting. There's lots of factors that go into this. Variations in hospital staffing, certainly access to specialists and care processes during the weekends. every day is not the same in the hospital. And so the level of service may not be as great. And this is particularly important, I think, in the immediate 24 hours after a surgery, when if something does start to go sideways, it needs to be noted and dealt with very promptly. The weakened effect has also been associated with the automotive industry, where legend has it that vehicles built on a Friday were thought to have more problems, loose and missing bolts and other mentally checked out mechanics who were, you know, thinking about what they were going to do Friday night or Saturday night. Research has explored this before, and some have found increased mortality on Fridays. Some have not. So they decided to do this retrospective study. 25 different common surgical procedures that were done in Ontario between 2007 and 2019. So one group was those who went surgery one day before the weekend, Friday or pre-holiday, and those who had surgery one day after the weekend, Monday or post-holiday. They looked at short-term, 30-day, 90-day, and long-term post-operative outcomes, and the analysis found that the pre-weekend patient group had longer hospital stays than those in the post-weekend, a 5% higher likelihood of experience a combination of the endpoints, which were mortality, complications, and readmissions within 30 days. The rate of death was 9% higher at 30 days, and it actually kept going up with 10% higher mortality at 90 days, and get this, 12% higher at 1 year. Also intriguingly, scheduled or elective procedures performed before the weekend were associated with worse postoperative outcomes, while unplanned, more urgent surgeries showed slightly better outcomes when performed before the weekend. Now, the surgeons operating on Fridays had a median age of 47 compared to 48 on those operating Mondays. The median years in practice were 14 years for Friday surgeries versus 17 years for Monday surgeries. These are averages, by the way. So what that suggests is that maybe the lower status doctors, the junior partners, were operating on Friday. I don't know if that is actually the case, but that would certainly be what I would infer from these statistics. Even though the age difference isn't that much, it's going to be younger people in the Friday group, possibly less experienced, pulling that number down. I don't believe that anyone is suggesting the possibility of negligence, but I do think that systems and functional factors such as seniority and experience could be at work here. That's the when. Now, I want to take just a moment to address the where, because where I work and practice, we have one of the Meccas, you know, it's sort of Stanford University Hospital System is sort of like being near the Cleveland Clinic or Mayo Clinic. I mean, it's got a huge rep, very, very competitive hiring. So to get hired there generally suggests either you're extremely good or you're extremely connected. But when you go to one of these Mecca-like hospitals, tertiary teaching hospitals, you should be going there because you are interesting, because you have something unusual, because you have a complicated problem, because then you're going to be seeing the top people. If you go there with something really basic, like tonsillectomy or breast biopsy or an appendectomy, be aware you're probably going to be seeing a very junior doctor, possibly even a first-year resident or so-called intern. Now, these are licensed physicians, but they haven't had the practice. So there'll be someone standing over them supervising, but at a minimum, your surgery is probably going to take longer. And that maybe is not what you necessarily want for elderly patients who tend to have worse results from anesthesia And when you're learning something, as I'm sure everyone can relate to, you do it a little more slowly. You want to do it correctly, so you take your time. And that can actually have some unintended adverse consequences for the patient. So what's the message here? Well, the message is think about that weekend effect, and particularly for elective surgeries, the so-called routine surgeries, maybe you want to shoot for a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday for your case. Now, we've been hearing an awful lot about AI lately, and these AI models trained on patient speech are really fascinating. The AI may know what you need before you do, and they're showing promise for diagnosing some mental health conditions, even over the phone or through sound waves recorded on an MP3 and then uploaded to the analytic device. It works by analyzing the acoustic properties of speech. These AI models can identify markers of depression or anxiety, even if the patient themselves is not aware of it. Through individual features like pitch, tone, rhythm, each play a role. The true power of these models lies in their ability to discern patterns that are imperceptible to the psychiatrist or the psychologist's ears. Now, we know that large language models can trawl transcribed interviews for patterns of speech and contextual cues that might be symptomatic of psychological disorders, but these large language models are flawed. They reflect the linguistic biases prevalent in society. For example, one large language model failed to diagnose depression in Black patients compared to white patients. And furthermore, the LLMs are known to hallucinate, so they generate plausible but factually incorrect information. So that's worrisome when we're talking about labeling someone with a psychiatric diagnosis. But these new methods do not have the flaw of a large language model because they don't pay attention to words. Rather, they look at subtle changes in the person's voice. The researchers hypothesize that those with depression may have distinctive ways of speaking that are too subtle for the human ear to detect. So, as with most AIs, they use pre-training, where they expose the model to huge amounts of general speech to help it recognize audio patterns. These patterns might include variations in rhythm, pitch variability, and vocal quality that are imperceptible to the human ear. I exaggerated some right there for you, but this is being described as a linguistic tuning fork. So just as a piano tuner uses tuning forks to tighten or loosen the strings, the linguistic tuning fork allows the system to pick up little variations without needing to understand the words. They then fine-tune the general purpose analysis for depression with the help of playing at voices of patients with depression and then saying, okay, that's depression. Okay, that's not. And so then they tested for accuracy. Nature Science Reports in June of last year was able to detect the presence of depression in a classification task 96% of the time and was 95% accurate when asked to categorize the into four categories: no depression, mild, moderate, and severe, based on just one rating. Researchers at the Sorbonne in Paris have developed a method which analyzes sound waves recorded via a smartphone. The sound waves are converted into visual maps called spectrograms that chart how a voice's frequency and volume vary over time. And then the model examines features for indicative of various psychiatric disorders, including depression, anxiety, insomnia, and fatigue. Now, being able to differentiate between those, that's pretty impressive. Now, this is using deep learning techniques extracting data from raw audio, which is very analogous to how these AIs work. But it's not working within a language. It's working across languages. So this could be especially helpful in rural areas or in areas where there's a large percentage of people who don't speak the language well enough for a psychiatrist or a psychologist to really get the subtleties. But the subtleties are there embedded in the way the person speaks. So now we need to move forward and validate these. But as a screening technique, particularly in a busy clinical setting like a hospital, I think this could be extremely helpful to get people the care they need, even though they may be in for something else. And early access to mental health care is one of the great challenges that our society faces. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Doan.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Ayin.
Uh-huh. And where are you calling locally?
Santa Cruz, yes.
Okay, great. What can I do for you, Ayin?
Well, I have a question about the measles outbreak. You know, I heard it reported today that there's a worldwide measles outbreak, including areas in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I also heard that our Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy Jr., his response was that the measles vaccine causes the very thing it's supposed to cure. I was wondering, what is your educated take on the vaccines and Mr. Kennedy's response?
All right. Well, let's first of all talk a little bit about different kinds of vaccines. We can, for example, if we want to talk about the COVID vaccine, the vaccine is not giving you the virus. They're giving you a piece of the virus, the spike protein. And in the case of the COVID vaccine that is made with RNA, messenger RNA, they're not even giving you a piece of the virus. They're giving you the blueprint to make the piece of the virus and then expecting your own cells to go ahead and turn out this broken virus fragment, which is exactly what they do. The nice thing about this technology is that it's a plug and play, and you can put any messenger RNA in there. Other vaccines are much more complicated to make. You're either going to be using, in the case of flu vaccine, for example, you choose your strain of flu, and then you grow it in eggs. And that's why it takes like 6 months to get enough flu vaccine together for the next round of influenza. And then you purify the compound, and then you make the vaccine. So it's a lot of work. And other vaccines are made with a piece of actual living virus that's been beaten up and attenuated and kicked around and until it's really no longer infectious, but it still has the surface markers. And under most circumstances, a normal person's immune system is going to be fine with just, you know, learning how to kill that virus and not getting sick from it. But let's suppose a person is on high-dose immunosuppressants for an organ transplant, or they're pregnant. Those are circumstances when you absolutely cannot or should not, on purpose, give a live virus vaccine because there's a chance of it infecting the fetus or, in the case of the immunosuppressed adult, the adult. Now, this only happens in certain very specific circumstances. So while it is factually true that the measles virus can give you measles, it only gives people who are extremely vulnerable or pregnant measles, and we don't give it to them. So I would say that it is one of those factually true but clinically unimportant statements, but it isn't a lie. So with the measles vaccine, I think he's indulging in a little bit of rhetorical legerdemain, if you will. Light-handedness is what that means in French, and it's the sort of thing that, oh, a magician does, you know, and when he pulls the coin out of your left ear. That's an illusion, and it doesn't mean what it appears to mean, right? So that's my thought on that. Measles vaccine, if you get measles, and anyone probably born before 1954 for sure had measles. They either had clinical measles or they had a subclinical case that, you know, they got exposed to enough of it to get the antibodies and the lifelong immunity. When the measles vaccine came out, we thought it was good for life because infections were good for lifelong immunity. And it wasn't until the early 90s that we started having something called atypical measles. And atypical measles was when someone who had never gotten measles got the measles shot as a child, and then they got into their 20s and 30s, and they were exposed to measles. And they didn't get classic measles, but some of them got very, very sick, which is what happens when adults get measles. It's particularly bad for adults and infants. But under most circumstances, back in the day, we were all getting measles as children, or getting exposed to it enough that we had a natural immunity. The vaccine then became a two-part vaccine. We gave those young adults a second dose of measles vaccine, and then we figured out that if we waited, you know, do it at 15 months and then do it again at before kindergarten, that those individuals 30 years later weren't getting atypical measles and kept their blood level of the antibodies against measles, which can easily be tested for. It's a simple blood test at any laboratory. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. But just to go back to the first vaccines, you were talking about those born before, was it 1950, did you say? Let's just
54.
Say
yeah, 54.
54. What if you were born prior to that? Are you saying that
you probably are immune?
Exposed?
Yeah, I am. I'm saying you probably were immune, but if you want to check, there's a simple blood test that your doctor can order. It's called a measles titer, T-I-T-E-R, not T-I-G-H-T-E-R, T-I-T-E-R. And you can just request the measles titer, especially in the, and there is a payment code. You say, okay, we're in the middle of a measles epidemic. I want to check the measles titer on my patient. And they don't have a clinical history. They don't know for sure they had measles. They don't think they're vaccinated. Let's find out.
Okay. So in lieu of the test, would you just say generally across the board, would you recommend people born before 1954 get a measles vaccine or not?
It won't hurt you either way.
Okay.
If you've got antibody, your antibody will simply clean up the small amount of measles that's being injected into you effectively. And so that's no big deal. And maybe it's like tetanus. You know, when you get a tetanus shot too early and your arm gets sore, that's like the worst thing that can happen is you'll have a sore arm. And that's not too terrible. You will goose your immunity, which may be unnecessary, but it shouldn't cause you any complications.
And would you recommend people with young children to get the measles vaccine?
It depends on how young and whether their parents have vaccinated them.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If you're working, if you're working in a Mennonite daycare center, I would certainly recommend getting vaccinated or checking your titer, because you will, you know, not to rag on the Mennonites, they have lots of good, very positive health practices. I trained in an area which was very rich in the Seventh-day Adventist faith, and their general health practices, their diet, their other behaviors are very, very beneficial. And so, you know, good, clean living is great for longevity. And I think also community is great for longevity. But in the case of you simply want to look at your exposures and look at your vulnerability.
I see. Well, thank you, Dr. Dawn. It was very informative. I really appreciate all that great information.
Happy to oblige. Keep listening.
Okay, bye now.
Bye now. Okay, I promised you 678 nuns, 30 years, and brains. The nun study was conceived by an epidemiologist and a neurology professor named David Snowden in 1986. And he got together with the School Sisters of Notre Dame in Texas and got them to agree to be the experimental subjects. So these 678 women were tracked for more than 30 years, took tests of their various aging markers and also cognitive markers. Things, some interesting studies came out of that. I remember one published about maybe 15 years ago that said that you could look at the writing of the nuns, and you could, the ones that were developing, that eventually developed dementia, you would start to see 10 or 15 years before they had any testable dementia that their speech was becoming more simple. And there were some changes in handwriting and orthographics, more spelling errors and things like that. But very, very definitely fewer words and less complicated words, but still, you know, very lucid. So that was one of the early findings. They also found some interesting things around estrogen in the nun study. Some of the nuns were taking estrogen after menopause. Some were not. This was where the first data showing that estrogen was in fact neuroprotective came from. Even with an Alzheimer's diagnosis, there are some unknown protective mechanisms at work that correlate with a few interesting things. Early life linguistic ability and grammatical complexity created a lower risk of impairment later in life. Cause and effect, some underlying difference in the way the brain wired, we can't say. But we do know about the brains because part of this study is that when the nuns died, we got their brains. The researchers got their brains and analyzed them. And in a recent paper, this was published February of this year, called The Nun Study, Insights from 30 Years of Aging and Dementia Research, we get to see some of the highlights. The Biggs Institute has all of the donated brain autopsy material and is correlating that. So among their findings, they identified factors contributing to cognitive resilience despite the presence of the beta amyloid and tau protein Alzheimer's pathology. Some people, and this is also extremely important, had high levels of the quote-unquote toxic Alzheimer's protein, but were cognitively intact until death and passing all their tests. The study also looked at ApoE4 and ApoE2, which are a genotype variation. The ApoE gene plays a role in the metabolism of fats, and what we know also is that the ApoE gene people with that allele are much better at fighting off infectious disease. So it's possible that their ability to fight off infectious disease as they age and develop things in the brain that can be mistaken for a pathogen might lead to a misfiring of the immune system and excessive collateral damage to the brain, leading eventually to Alzheimer's. This is one of the more prevalent hypotheses about what could be going on. I mentioned already high idea density and grammatical complexity in young adulthood, correlated with a lower risk of cognitive impairment later in life. Another very interesting thing that came out of the nun study was that most of the cases of dementia in this group of women involved mixed pathologies, and there were three in particular. So it wasn't pure Alzheimer's disease. Maybe Alzheimer's disease, as Dale Bredesen suggests, is a symptom. Maybe the presence of that beta amyloid is a symptom or a result of other pathologies. For example, there's one called limbic predominant age-related TDP-43 encephalopathy. And this is abnormal clumps of another protein, TDP-43. There's also hippocampal sclerosis of aging, which is damage to the hippocampus that happens with age. This is probably an oxidative stress thing, similar to what happens to sun-exposed skin over time, the oxidative stress in that case coming from the ultraviolet radiation. There's also vascular dementia. And vascular dementia is where the tiny blood vessels that feed parts of the brain clog up and hundreds of small little infarctions result, interfering with the wiring and the rapid movement of thought and association across the synaptic web. And we all have different synaptic webs. So where those little white spots on the CT scan are make a huge difference. We just can't read it yet. So the Nunn study has provided us with an amazing amount of information, and I think we should be very grateful to the sisters for their generous contribution to our knowledge. Now, I recall that we're all interested in staying sharp as we age, and this is definitely a good story about that. Some years ago, I listened to an interview on the news, and they were talking to a reporter who had gone to a DARPA laboratory. That's the defense research people, and they do some really interesting stuff. And there they had put a helmet on her head and taken her out to the firing range. And while she was wearing that helmet, which provided electrical stimulation to her occipital cortex, which is where your vision is seated, she was a crack shot and was able to hit, you know, the close to the middle of the bullseye, although she was not an experienced markswoman. And then when they took the helmet off, not so good. When they turned the helmet off, she reverted to just a novice. Well, if you can improve a person's marksmanship, it stands to reason that electrical stimulation across the skull might actually be able to improve a person's memory. And that's what this study looked at. Repeated sections of electrical stimulation to brain networks associated with memory improved verbal learning in some Alzheimer's patients, and the effect lasted for up to 8 weeks. The trial tested the effectiveness of transcranial direct current stimulation, which sends an electrical current through electrodes affixed to the scalp, and these are just soft electrodes like you might have for an EEG, but they're placed over targeted brain lesions. And they did this study in a group of people who had Alzheimer's disease, 25 patients with Alzheimer's disease coming from specialty clinics all over the Dallas-Fort Worth area took part in the study. And they got 20 minutes it was 10 days, sped over 2 weeks, so, you know, 5 days on weekdays, then nothing over the weekend, then come back and get 5 more days. So 10 treatments in all for 20 minutes, or they got placebo. Now, I want to point out that it really wasn't a placebo trial. Participants in the neurostimulation group received current levels that caused tingling, itching, or prickling sensations on their scalp. I have such a device that was supposed to help sleeping, and it helped people induce deep-level sleep where you were putting these little wet cotton pads on your temples. And yes, I've felt that tingling, itching, prickling sensation And I guess once you fall asleep, it might help improve deep sleep. But getting down into sleep with that thing kind of buzzing at you was not exactly easy. However, in this study, they were looking at verbal learning, the patient's ability to recall a series of words soon after hearing them. We've all had that test, right? They remember a fox, a owl, a butter dish, and a cup of coffee. And then 10 minutes later, the person asks you, and you're like, yeah, there was a butter dish or something. So they applied this transcranial direct electrical stimulation to the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. It's in the frontal lobe, around the temples, and I told you already what they got. One-third of the neuro-stimulated patients had meaningful improvement in verbal learning. And for those, oddly enough, who received the lower current, they did better. The effects on them persisted for 8 weeks. 25% of patients who received neurostimulation at a lower current and 33% who received the higher current noted meaningful improvements in their ability to rapidly produce words, such as naming objects and action. And again, the control group showed no meaningful improvement. So not everyone got the same results. As I said earlier, when we were talking about the nuns, we are all wired a little bit differently. So quite honestly, that some of the people that may not have been the right place to be stimulating. Brain imaging, customized placing, anatomical differences, these are all probably critical in getting our aim here. So right now we're using a shotgun, but we need to be using a sniper rifle to really zero in on the part of the brain that's doing the thing that we're seeking to improve. But as a proof of concept study, that this may someday be something that you could actually purchase and wear to help people remain in the home and remain independent, I don't think that's far-fetched at all. In fact, I think it's pretty likely. How well the device works, we won't know until we see. But that someone will come up with one and get it past the FDA, yeah, I'd be betting on that. In terms of research on dementia, we have another study here that is looking at psychological profiles. And before I go any further, let me say that you always have to take psychology studies with a grain of salt, because there's no blood test for negative thoughts, and correlation is not the same as causation. And so we can't say which is the chicken and which is the egg when we talk about personality traits and the risk of developing dementia. So let's move on and discuss what the researchers studied. This was at the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences and the Institute of Neuroscience at the University of Barcelona. He is a big wig. He's got lots of academic credits. I'm not going to read them. Recent studies identified psychological characteristics that might be associated with an increased risk or protection against cognitive decline, neurodegeneration, and clinical dementia. So, having repetitive negative thoughts, having a tendency to experience distress and perceived stress are associated with a higher risk, while having a sense of purpose in life or self-reflection, I guess that would mean meditation of some kind, are protective factors. This looked at data from 1,000 volunteers in an international study of aging, and they cross-referenced it. They looked at mental health, cognition, lifestyle, brain integrity, and they also measured cortical thickness as a way of looking at brain degeneration over time. Our brains do shrink as we age, but that shrinkage is roughly correlated with a loss of cognitive resilience, let's say, but not necessarily with dementia. There's plenty of people with lots of brain atrophy who are perfectly lucid, so it's not a good indicator. It's one of many things they looked at. But what's the low risk? Personality traits? Well, a sense of purpose, openness to new experiences. Those are the things that were associated with improved cognition, better, less brain atrophy, and also a lower adherence to healthy lifestyles. So there's a confound for you. Because, you know, risky, you know, eating crap and drinking are going to obviously have a negative effect on your brain. A high propensity for distress and negative thoughts also seemed to increase the risk of cognitive impairment and symptoms. And it also was associated, as you might expect, with depression, anxiety, cognitive complaints, loneliness, and sleep disorders. So the real problem here is correlation is not causality. And I really want to hammer that in and again and again, because a lot of the studies looking at exercise and lifespan, it's like, well, people who exercise this much live longer. Well, yeah, but if you're going to live longer because you're healthier, you'd be in the group who are exercising. And as people get sick, they lose strength and they stop or slow down on their amount of exercise because they have to. And it's whatever degenerative disease process that's going on that affects the exercise rather than the exercise affecting the degenerative disease process. See? It gets a little tricky. This next study could be a breakthrough for ALS research. And amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, sometimes still referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a terrible neurodegenerative disease. And we don't have a good biomarker. We have some candidates, however. So this study, which was done, which came through the University of Montpellier in France, looked at three different potential biomarkers: neurofilament light chain proteins, glial acidic proteins, and phosphorylated tau 181. Phosphorylated tau has also been associated with Alzheimer's disease. Neurofilaments change chain light chain proteins can be detected in the blood when nerve cells are injured or died. Glial acidic proteins are released when cells work to repair injury. And as I said, phosphorylated tau is linked to amyloid proteins in the brain. The study looked at 139 people who had ALS and 70 who did not, but had similar diseases, primary lateral sclerosis, lower motor neuron disease, things, in other words, that would look enough like ALS for you not to be sure what you were seeing. They followed the participants for 3.5 years for the people with ALS and about 12 years for the people who didn't. And during that time, that 86% of the people with ALS died because it is, in general, a lethal disease. The neurofilament light chain proteins were the winner as far as biomarkers go. ALS people had levels in their bloods three times higher than people with other diseases. The study also found that these neurofilament light chain tests correctly identified the people with ALS more than 80% of the time. That's a reasonably good specificity. The others were 50% of the time, which is pretty much not much better than chance, if at all better than chance. And also the level of these neurofilament light chain proteins can predict survival. So there was a threshold where if you were below that threshold, you were alive a year later. If you were above that threshold, you had already died by the time a year was up. So all of the people came from the same part of France. So there's obviously differences in diet, lifestyle, genetics, and a whole host of things in a French cohort compared with the broader humanity at large. So we can't generalize this, but it sure is interesting. Okay, let's talk about some interesting stuff in the microbiome. And, you know, it's curiouser and curiouser. I have to comment on the picture here because the lead researcher is a woman, and the graduate student is a woman, and the postdoc is a male. And the picture shows the male prominently in front, holding up a slide, looking learnedly at a microscope slide. Obviously not what you do with a microscope. I do note an abacus on the table. So that's pretty cool. I guess they still use an abacus in China. Nice to know. Microbes living in our guts help us digest food by reshaping the bile acids that our livers produce for breaking down fats. Now, it's the story of bile is kind of interesting. Bile actually starts out as hemoglobin. Bile is where hemoglobin goes to die. It doesn't die. It's reincarnated as bile. And as bile, it acts as a kind of emulsifier, a soap, in other words, that helps us digest fat, which is one of the basic macronutrients we need for life. Brain being 70% fat, we definitely need lots of fat to build these big, heavy brains of ours to, well, among other things, build microscopes. The link between bile acids and colon cancer risk was recently uncovered as scientists sought to better understand the relationship between gut microbes and our bodies. In many ways, that relationship revolves around a specific protein, the farnesoid X receptor, FXR, which helps maintain a healthy gut. It controls the production of bile acids in the liver, but it responds in different ways to the secondary bile acids. These are all essentially products of bacterial fermentation. Now, bile acids contain lots of toxins and trash because the body is getting rid of that. The liver has taken it out of circulation and has defanged it as much as possible and is now depositing it in the gut for elimination. What Dr. Fu and her colleagues had previously identified was, well, this FXR receptor is a promising drug target for treating inflammatory bowel disease because FXR has an anti-inflammatory property. They also have identified that there's two different microbial bile acids or secondary bile acids that have opposite effects on FXR. And one of them supports its function and the other inhibits it. So the bile acid that supports the protein's function actually slows the growth of bowel cancer, while the bile acid that inhibits FXR helps fuel the tumors. So inflammation is somehow supporting the tumor. Is it distraction? Is it collateral damage? We don't know that. But I will say an interesting little detail that we've known for a long time is that oral estrogen is anti-inflammatory and actually reduces the risk of cancer, while of the gut, although when you break estrogen down from oral consumption, you're going to increase your risk of blood clots, so it's not a good idea. But low amounts of ibuprofen, a couple of doses a week, are also associated with lower rates of colon cancer. So clearly, there's pretty good circumstantial evidence that inflammation is in the works here. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.